Thank you very much all for being with us this afternoon. It's my great privilege to be up here this afternoon to introduce U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch, certainly not a stranger to the Federalist Society and a good friend of our organization. My first experience with Senator Hatch dates back to 1985, when I was serving as a clerk on the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on the Constitution. And it was late one afternoon, and I was summoned into the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearing room to sit behind the senator and to fetch him whatever he needed. Before us was Alex Kaczynski, who was seeking confirmation to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We were held up in the hearing room for several hours as Democrat members of the Judiciary Committee sought to caricature Kaczynski through the recitation of innuendo and rumor intended to challenge his fairness, integrity, and temperament. And this was routine grist for the confirmation mill then, starting somewhere, I think, around 1984. I learned two things from that experience. First, that Senator Hatch had great wisdom about the thrust and parry of the legislative process and the long-term dangers to abusing it. That afternoon, he predicted that the kind of behavior we were witnessing would set in motion a fundamental change in the way judicial confirmations would proceed, requiring Republican presidential nominees to rebuff certain policy and jurisprudential litmus tests. Secondly, I also learned that senators are stingy. The hearing went on for so long that the senator had missed lunch, and it fell upon me to buy him a tuna fish sandwich, for which, Senator, you have never paid me back. But, you know, that is a debt that I have long written off. So you don't have to reach into your pocket, because we are, in fact, all indebted to you for the many occasions you have fought to secure a judiciary that is true to the Constitution as written. Your irrepressible defense of William Rehnquist, Robert Bork, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, during their divisive confirmation battles was unparalleled. Now, to be sure, the federal judiciary's work to return our country to respect for the structural Constitution may be relatively modest and scattershot, but for now, it has done more to reinvigorate federalism and the separation of powers than any other branch of the federal government. And I am rather certain that that would not have been the case had Senator Hatch not been on watch. Senator, welcome once again to the Federalist Society.
Well, thank you so much. That's nice of you. Very, very nice of you. Thank you. He's a cheap little bugger, isn't he? He wouldn't even... He's my friend, as has every member of the Federal Society been. I'm grateful to be with you. You know, I come from a state that is the second driest state in the Union. And I have to say that I once represented my faith, the Mormon Church, at the United Presbyterian College in New Wilmington, Pennsylvania, Westminster College. And the president, the Presbyterian minister, got up and he introduced me and he told this story. He said, this fellow died. He went up to St. Peter and he said, where do I go from here? And Peter said, well, you're a borderline case. He said, you have your choice. You can either go to heaven or down below. He said, of course I know which one you're going to choose. He said, well, don't be so sure. He said, I'd like to hear the differences between the two. And Peter said, well, he said, heaven, that's a land of smooth-flowing brooklets and streams and green forests and green pasture land and good companionship and everything. He said, hell, all that is one old hot, vast, dry desert. And the fellow said, well, he said, I kind of like the heat. And Peter thought, oh, gosh, not another one. So they went down the gates of hell and explained the differences again, and the man relentlessly wanted to go to hell. So finally they got to the gates of hell, and Peter said, look, fellow, the joke has gone far enough. He said, heaven's a land of smooth flowing brooks and streams and green forests and green pasture land and good companionship and everything. He said, all this place is one old hot, vast, dry desert. And the guy said, well, I'd just soon have the heat. And so Peter said, okay, buddy, you made your choice. And he opened up the gates and he looked in there and there were smooth, babbling brooklets and streams and green forests and green pasture. And he said, oh, those damn Mormons, they've been irrigating again. I think you got too much kick out of that one. I'll be honest with you, I was flabbergasted. But I loved every minute of it. Well, thank you, Leonard. Leonard has done such a great job, as have the other leaders here in the Federalist Society. I'm just very proud of him. And you can see our judges are, too, our conservative judges. To show up like they do, I saw Scalia last night. He's a great friend. I remember when Scalia came to me. Someday I'll talk to you about that, about all the confirmations that we've been through. Clarence Thomas, my gosh, he's like a brother to me. And of course, Sam Alito. All three were there last night. I was pretty impressed. I'm honored to be here today. Actually, I'm surprised to see so many lawyers here on a Friday afternoon. It reminds me of a story. You know, three colleagues at a law firm, a paralegal and an associate, and a partner, I don't know what's the matter with my nose, but it keeps running, are walking to lunch when they stumble across an antique oil lamp. When they rub the dirt off the lamp, a genie appears in a puff of smoke. The genie says, I can only grant a total of three wishes, so I'll give each of you just one. The paralegal says, well, me first. I want to be in the Bahamas driving a speedboat without a care in the world. With a poof, she was gone. The associate says, me next, he said. I want to be skiing down the beautiful slopes of Park City, Utah, with the love of my life at my side. With another poof, the genie whisks her away as well. The genie turns to the partner in the law firm and says, now it's your turn. The partner replies, I want them both back in the office after lunch. Many of you understand that very well. I understand. In all seriousness, it's truly an honor to be here with you today. The Federalist Society has long been near and dear to my heart, and I've been a proud member for decades. And so is my son, who helps with the society. Brent is practicing law in Utah, and held three positions at justice, headed three divisions, and was associate White House counsel under Bush 1. And he misses being here this time. I might say that I've been a proud member for decades, and contrary to some of the left's more vivid fantasies, our society isn't some right-wing cabal. It's a forum for vibrant debate among our diverse membership, made up of conservatives, libertarians, and moderates, and I might add even some liberals who really like to come. The Federalist Society was born out of a reaction to the unbridled activism of the Supreme Court in the 1960s and 70s. For decades, our mission has come from a shared antipathy to the policy-driven manipulation of the law in service of political ends. Today, the society stands united against the current president's unprecedented executive overreach. We Federalists care deeply about the separation of powers and the rule of law. And these past 6 years have seen myriad of uses by this administration. Beyond the legal realm, dissatisfaction with the president has grown as Americans increasingly worry that his policies have left us less prosperous at home and certainly less secure in the world. The American people went to the polls last week and delivered a decisive blow to the president. Yeah, amen. And his progressive agenda, I get a big kick out of them using the word progressive. My gosh, they're just straight old dumbass liberals anyway. They put conservative majorities in charge of the legislative branch and gave us the opportunity to steer this nation out of Obama's hands and into a better direction. But articulating the case against the Obama administration is the easy part. Advancing our convictions through the constructive task of governing is much harder. This challenge is only made more difficult by the divisions we face as a conservative movement. Some commentators eagerly highlight divisions on the political right. between Tea Party and establishment purists, Tea Party and establishment purists and pragmatists, libertarians and social conservatives, populists and elites, hawks and isolationists. It is incumbent upon those of us who seek to lead, especially those of us who hold elected office, to devote a positive, constructive agenda. We have to develop that can help unite such factions and present a compelling vision to Americans searching for a way out of our current problems. We must offer solutions, not shutdowns. Developing a shared national vision must involve more than simply identifying a set of policy proposals that satisfy various ideological constituencies. We must root our agenda in timeless principles and explain to the American people why those principles and the policies that flow from them offer our best way forward. Despite what some critics might say, I have been a committed conservative throughout my entire public life, and I came to it the hard way. I was raised a Democrat in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, learned a skilled trade, worked in the building and construction trade unions for 10 years, went all the way through BYU as a liberal Democrat. That's not an easy thing to do, by the way. I have to say, but at the end I thought, I don't believe this stuff anymore, and I changed. Today, I still cherish the first principles that I first brought here to Washington part of the vanguard of the Reagan Revolution in the Senate. As a conservative, I have always been struck by how the fundamental insight of conservatism lies at the root of the word to conserve. To be a conservative means to be committed to preserving the institutions and traditions that have made this nation so great and free. Conservatives recognize that our Constitution gave us a precious gift, a system of government that is both active and restrained. The Constitution endows the federal government with the powers to confront inevitable challenges, but it also checks those powers. This central thrust of the Constitution, the creation of a limited but capable government, in turn helps to preserve a society where families and communities have space to thrive. We conservatives revere and defend the Constitution, not merely because it protects individual liberty and self-government, but also because it helps make real the kind of society in which our civic and social institutions can flourish. I've been greatly encouraged in recent years by the renewed focus among conservatives on the Constitution itself. As we seek to develop a positive, affirmative agenda, we must always keep the Constitution as our guide. By restoring the Constitution as our foundation, we remain true to the title conservative. We conserve our founding principles and apply those principles to today's challenges. Now, this must be an active process and one that each of us has an independent obligation to undertake. For too long, most Americans have treated the Constitution as an exclusive province of the judiciary. But legislators like myself cannot simply rely on judges to tell us whether our proposals are constitutional. This tendency to leave things to the courts diminishes the other branch's role in the constitutional system and misses the many lessons that the Constitution has to teach. And while the courts are charged with the important task of saying what the law is and not what the law should be, the judiciary's role in assessing constitutionality is a narrow one. Judges ask primarily whether a law satisfies some legal rule announced in a previous case, usually, whether it's the regulated activity in commerce. Is the punishment for noncompliance a tax or a penalty? And we've seen that in recent days. But my role as a legislator is not usually about deciding questions of policy based on legalistic reasoning or seeking to restore the 1789 or the 1868 office. Fidelity to the Constitution also means looking to the principles that undergird it. Values like individual liberty, respect for civil society, and popular accountability, in determining whether a proposed course of action is wise. Obamacare provides a ready example. I have challenged the constitutionality of Obamacare from its inception. Notwithstanding the Supreme Court's contortions, the individual mandate undoubtedly exceeds Congress's powers under the Constitution. But that is not the only reason Obamacare conflicts with the Constitution. In addition to flunking formal legal tests, it violates many of the enduring principles made manifest in the Constitution. It invades liberty by compelling individuals to purchase insurance against their will. It undermines federalism by coercing the state governments to expand Medicaid. It dilutes the separation of powers by transferring vast legislative authority to the executive, and so on. Americans are increasingly recognizing the many flaws and problems with Obamacare, and it's just about to hit. They kept it carefully in abeyance until this election was over. I heard recently, in fact, that Obamacare's approval rating has hit a new low. Unfortunately, I can't give you the exact number because it's listed on the Obamacare website. I'm glad you're still listening. Every once in a while, I just got to throw one of those in just to keep you awake. Whether or not a law meets whatever legal test the Supreme Court has set forth does not end the inquiry for those of us who seek the Constitution as our guide. Indeed, we must practice what some call political constitutionalism. The notion that it falls mostly to political actors making political decisions to protect and promote constitutional goals. The Constitution has many lessons to teach about good lawmaking. The checks on government power ensure accountability. The most decisions affecting Americans' lives should be made at the local level, not by some distant federal bureaucracy, and that consistent with the Constitution. Many divisions of power, sudden lurches in policymaking, should be avoided, while more modest improvements supported by broad coalitions are encouraged. Perhaps most fundamentally, the Constitution teaches the virtue of prudence. Prudence is a habit of mind that really comes naturally to conservatives. It restrains us from seeking immediate and complete vindication of a single abstract principle. Rather, it counsels us to work within our existing circumstances to advance the enduring principles upon which liberty depends. Prudent lawmakers make real-world experience, not abstract theory, their guide, and recognize that success requires harmonizing competitive values or competing values. The Constitution is an exercise in such prudence. It contains within its structure a clash of many competing institutions, the Democratic majoritarian House, the deliberative Senate, although in the last number of years it hadn't been very deliberative. We certainly haven't had any votes, I'll tell you. The unified and energetic executive and the independent judiciary. There is tension between individual rights and majority will, energy and stability, limited powers, and flexibility to act. The Constitution mediates many rival goods. It is founded on compromise, and it institutionalizes prudence as a signal virtue of our republic. Conservatives have been most successful when we have tempered our ideological zeal with the prudence necessary to produce practical results. Many conservative leaders and thinkers eagerly wrapped themselves in the mantle of Ronald Reagan, but as time has passed, President Reagan's legacy has increasingly become prone to misappropriation and misuse. I recommend a recent essay in Commentary Magazine by Henry Olson and Peter Wehner that dispels some of the myths that have been perpetuated about Reagan, including claims that he was an inflexible ideologue. I was a personal friend of President Reagan, a foot soldier of the Reagan Revolution. I went to 36 states for Ronald Reagan, but I was a foot soldier in the Senate, and I was the recipient of what I am told was his only pre-primary endorsement ever. That really meant a lot to me. I was going to win the election by about 9 points. according to the pollsters. Reagan came up there and endorsed me, and I won almost 2-1. It made a difference, and I was very happy to see that. When I see someone misappropriating President Reagan for their own purposes, I often feel duty-bound to defend my fellow to remind my fellow conservatives that President Reagan never prized ideological purity over concrete results. When faced with divided government, he did not choose a my way or the highway approach. Instead, he searched for areas of agreement. That meant accepting some of our noble goals, such as restraining spending and reforming the administrative state. These were out of reach at the time, but it enabled President Reagan to make meaningful progress in other equally critical areas like pro-growth tax relief and bolstering our national defense, progress that helped produce economic prosperity and won the Cold War. Today, we honor President Reagan's legacy not by mischaracterizing his record or engaging in idol worship, but instead by thoughtfully emulating his leadership adapted to the challenges of today. Ronald Reagan was truly one of the greatest leaders in our nation's history. And I'm really pleased to see even the liberal analysts pretty much admitting that today. I should know. I've been around for most of it. And as the age of Reagan, our task today as conservatives is to conserve, to retain what works, what is true to our constitutional structure, as we work to correct the excesses of recent years and decades. For some programs like Obamacare, this means seeking to repeal the program root and branch and replace it with one that is both more effective and more in line with limited government and a free society. For other programs that have become more embedded in the fabric of American society, advancing reforms consistent with the cause of constitutionalism will involve more incremental improvements. Now that we have a renewed ability to pursue our legislative priorities, laying out a principled, forward-looking conservative agenda is more important than ever. In a recent speech I made at the Reagan Ranch in California, and you know, that was the first time that I really went up to the actual ranch, which is really a sight to behold. I couldn't believe how primitive he lived. I don't know how Nancy put up with it, and she didn't want to put up with it, but she did because she loved him so much. But he loved it. Where the tack room for his saddles and everything was really a lot more fancy than the house. It was pretty good. And then I spoke down at what's called the Reagan Ranch down in Santa Barbara, where they had a luncheon for me, and I was able to speak there. But there I laid out a number of my own ideas, including patient-centered healthcare reforms to enhance choice and restrain costs, tax reform to spur economic growth and create jobs, and an innovation agenda to build the economy of the future. And of course, a social mobility agenda to help all of our fellow citizens live the American dream. In my remaining time today, I want to discuss some ideas for regulatory reform. I consider this extremely important for conservatives, for our people, for our country. It's an issue of particular interest to Federalist Society members. In particular, I wish to suggest how the incoming Senate majority can model our legislative approach on the constitutional conservative vision that I've just articulated. A room such as this is full of separation of powers enthusiasts. At the mere mention of the monstrosity that is the current administrative state, many of you are willing and ready to launch a crusade in the name of the non-delegation doctrine. Let me assure you that I share your sentiments. Regulatory reform has become a focus for me since my early days in the Senate. Twice, in 1981, again in 1995, I led comprehensive regulatory reform efforts that nearly became law. Today, major reform once again seems within reach, and it is more important now than ever. But we must also acknowledge that many do not share our zeal for the finer points of structural constitutional law. Indeed, in the past, progressives have successfully labeled most regulatory reform efforts as attempts to discard even the most basic regulations, trolling out a parade of horribles like dirty air and polluted water and poisonous children's toys. They're good at that. They're good at scaring people. They're not good at governing. Such rhetoric holds great sway with the general public because most of us want clean air and water, safe children's toys, and the like. As a society, we've come to expect and rely on a basic level of health and safety regulation. As much as we may deplore the modern administrative state's constitutional infirmities, seeking to tear down the entire regulatory state in one fell swoop, or to end the federal government's power to regulate full stop, does not amount to a serious governing agenda, not under current circumstances. By instead crafting our proposals to respond to the most pressing problems presented by an overweening administrative state, I believe we can make serious progress by rolling back the regulatory menace. Perhaps the two most troublesome features of the modern administrative state are, first, the size of our regulatory burden, and second, the lack of accountability in the regulatory process. The growing federal regulatory burden has become a concern for decades, but the problem is now worse than ever before. Both the number of regulations and their combined cost have exploded in recent years. The American people are now bound by more than 1 million individual restrictions in the Federal Register, with a total cost of around $1.86 trillion, with a T, dollars each year. To put that in perspective, that's about 11% of our total GDP. It amounts to around $15,000 per household, and it totals over $300 billion more than combined annual individual and corporate taxes. In short, our regulatory burden is enormous. As I like to say, government is great at putting your money where its mouth is. Even as we resist President Obama's mad dash to add new rules, our nation simply cannot afford to ignore the crushing burden of existing regulations. They weigh down our efforts to boost economic growth and make it impossible to get our country back on track. Every president, from Jimmy Carter to Barack Obama, and I've known them all, has embraced the notion that outdated, unsuccessful, or otherwise ineffective regulations should be repealed. Nevertheless, the cumulative regulatory burden has continued to expand year after year. To address this growing problem, I plan to introduce the Scrub Act. Listen to this title: Searching for and Cutting Regulations That Are Unnecessarily Burdensome. I think that's it. But we wanted to tone it down to the Scrub Act, which I think covers it very well. Well, this legislation creates a bipartisan commission to examine the entire administrative corpus in search of regulations that are obsolete, outdated, ineffective, overlapping, duplicative, or unjustified. Its goal is to achieve a 15% cost reduction in our nation's total regulatory burden. The commission can recommend either immediate repeal or incremental reform through a flexible cut-as-you-go procedure that ensures a smooth process for agencies, the regulated community, and the public. The Scrub Act, I love that term. The Scrub Act turns a long-standing bipartisan commitment to retrospective regulatory review from mere rhetoric into meaningful reality. It would result in lower prices, higher wages, and more job opportunities for hardworking Americans. All the while, such common sense regulatory review poses no risk to our health, our safety, or our environment. It's the kind of legislation that can earn support from both sides of the aisle, and for which a realistic path for having it enacted into law. It is exactly the sort of reform that constitutional conservatives should champion because it helps restore individual liberty, fuels shared prosperity, and addresses many of our pressing economic challenges. A second critical flaw in the current administrative state is a fundamental lack of accountability in how federal government makes and enforces regulations. I hardly need to rehash how broken the regulatory process has become, how agencies and interest groups manipulate the rules and stack the deck against innovators and entrepreneurs and ordinary citizens. Abuses of the regulatory process have become so commonplace, they have almost come to be expected and too often are ignored. The Chevron case is a perfect illustration that they rely on and hide behind. To me, it's awful. Thankfully, there are a number of meaningful avenues for potential reform. I've been encouraged by many good ideas for retooling the Administrative Procedure Act, including the latest iteration of the Regulatory Accountability Act introduced by my friend Rob Portman, who's on my finance committee with me. This important legislation provides much needed relief to individuals and businesses by restoring regulatory transparency, requiring evidence-based rulemaking, and ensuring that agencies comply with their basic duty to conduct cost-benefit analysis for the new burdens they seek to impose on all of us. But one area that has thus far escaped much legislative attention is the role the federal judiciary plays in the regulatory process. Given the broad authorities Congress has ceded to the administrative agencies, the courts often stand as the only true independent check on increasingly out-of-control regulators. But recent abuses by the political branches have created serious challenges for effective and appropriate judicial review of the regulatory process. By writing vague laws, Congress has created extraordinary flexible grants of authority that are both unwise and constitutionally troublesome. Judicial deference to agency interpretations of the law has magnified this power to an extreme degree. Although originally intended as a means of curtailing judicial activism, Chevron and associated doctrines have resulted in a gross misallocation of lawmaking authority. Such doctrines have consigned courts to be rubber stamps rather than effective checks on administrative overreach. The threat of toothless judicial oversight of increasingly problematic regulatory action was only heightened when President Obama and his allies packed the D.C. court with compliant judges who are even less inclined to engage in meaningful administrative review. And Congress's creation of broadly available private rights, and by the way, while we're at that, I hope you're all arguing with our fellow senators. We should not return to the old rule. We should teach these blunderheads that they made a big mistake. And we have the votes to stop bad judges if we want to. And frankly, I intend to win with our candidate the presidency in 2016, and we will give them a taste of their own medicine. And we're going to win. We're going to win. These next 2 years are extremely important, maybe the most important 2 years in our history. I believe my colleagues, my brethren and sisters in the Republican Senate are going to help bring that up, are going to be successful in what we try to do. And already we've had a number of Democrats come up and say, we want to help. I wonder why they did that. Well, Congress's creation of broadly available private rights of action to challenge administrative decisions and regulatory activities has opened another avenue for abuse of the courts. While these provisions provide important opportunities for regulated parties to defend their liberties, Too often they have allowed groups with no concrete stake in the process to use the courts as a means to drive their own ideological agendas. Worse yet, inconsistent efforts by the judiciary to define the constitutional limits on standing have inadvertently created a perverse environment where businesses with real skin in the game are often shut out of court, while special interest groups with no meaningful injury in fact are allowed to litigate. Restoring the constitutionality of proper judicial role is vital to returning accountability to the regulatory process. In reviewing agency actions, courts should hear only real cases and controversies where litigants have concrete interests at stake. But when they do rule, they should say firmly what the law is and not simply ratify what the regulatory agencies argue that the law should be. Legislation to ensure meaningful reform on these fronts, to thereby bring the administrative state more in line with the Constitution, will be one of my top priorities in this new and coming Congress. Now, there are kinds of reforms that I believe conservatives should champion in the upcoming Congress and beyond. Unburdening Americans from a bloated, overweening regulatory state that seeks to police virtually every aspect of our lives will give citizens and communities room to thrive. It will also lead us to a richer, more robust society. You may recall the Life of Julia ad from President Obama's reelection campaign, which tells the story of a young woman who graduates college, has a child, and works until retirement, all with nary a mention of mother, father, brother, sister, husband, or other family member. Instead, Julia owes all of her successes and opportunities in life to the federal government, which is there to support her every step of the way. Reminds me a little bit about Hillary's recent comment. The ad is a perfect distillation of the ultimate end of the progressive state, and the ultimate end of the progressive state government as replacement for family and community, God and priest, mentor and friend. That is not the government our nation's founder envisioned, nor the one they created. Government's role is not to provide universal social and economic support, but rather to create opportunities and remove obstacles. You know, a vigorous, dynamic constitutional conservatism that includes regulatory reform among its chief priorities will help return our government to its proper role, that of supporter, not director. By keeping the Constitution as our guide and working to conserve our founding principles, we can offer an affirmative agenda to unite the conservative movement and win the hearts and minds of a broad majority of Americans looking for change. That's my goal. I think it should be yours. And if it isn't yours, get your rear ends in gear. It's about time we all get together and we stand together. We've had too many divisions in the Republican Party lately. We have a lot of conservatives with different viewpoints. They all ought to be part of the solution. We've got a lot of wonderful people out there who really, really know this country's been really smitten with bad policies. We've got a lot of people, and they're increasing in number. The Democrats think they won because it was a low voter turnout and it was a midterm election. Let's disabuse them of that feeling by winning 16, not just the Senate and House, but the presidency of the United States. And if we do, I hope you'll all be on my side in fighting for regulatory review the proper way. God bless all of you. I appreciate you very much.
We'll have time for just one question, and then the senator has to leave. So just one question, if someone wants. All right, we have one right here.
Senator, you mentioned the overreach by the administration.
The what?
Overreach. the overreach by the administration. We're about to see a big example of that in the amnesty. What do you think the Republicans can do about that, if anything?
Well, we've warned him that it's going to be catastrophic for him to do that. Part of it's our fault. We haven't really seized this problem. Of course, we haven't been in a position to do it either with the Democrats controlling the Senate. So I'm not blaming Republicans, but we really haven't seized that problem and found solutions for it. And the president, I'm convinced he doesn't think Congress exists, or he doesn't believe in the Congress of the United States. And frankly, I'd like to see immigration done the right way. But this president is prone to do through executive order that which he cannot do by working with the Congress, because he won't work with us. And if he'd work with us, I think we could get immigration bill through. The Senate bill was not perfect. And it did provide a pathway for citizenship, but it would take 15 years to be able to get on that pathway to citizenship or to obtain citizenship. And we made sure that they could not jump ahead of those who had played by the rules all these years, and that they had to jump through some hoops in order to become a citizen, which seems to me a fairly important way of doing things. I haven't found this president willing to work with us. Now, hopefully this election will cause him to do so, but right off the bat he says he's going to, by executive order, solve this problem. Well, I'll be, among others, probably the most interested in what that executive order consists of. I could go on, but let me just say that that's going to be a matter of great interest to all of us if he does make that unilateral decision without the help of the Congress. And he has a Republican Congress that's willing to work with him. That's the thing that's pretty interesting to me. I think the Congress is willing to work with him and see if we can find a mutually agreeable pathway to solve this problem. In any event, I'm going to be as interested as you in what he decides to do. We'll just have to wait and see. Anybody else? Well, I think I've worn you all out. You probably... Oh, okay. You'll be the last one.
Okay. Thanks for taking my question. So, Senator, you had said about this proposal to reform administrative law would be to increase the accountability to the American people. Do you think it would be possible to just make, I guess, some sort of a regime where the Congress would vote on Congress would vote on administrative regulation? So the administrative agency proposes something, and then the Congress has to vote on it to make it law. Thank you.
Well, that's possible. I have to say this: Congress has a right to vote anytime it wants to. Can overturn administrative laws with which it disagrees. I'm hopeful that this Congress will work together compatibly so that we can solve problems that literally are, unjustifiable problems. That's easier said than done. As you've seen, we've had fractionation in the Republican Party as well. In this last election, I've gone all over the country campaigning for our, especially our senators, but Congress people too. And I have to say that, and I've raised millions of dollars for them, too. And I'm 80 years old. My gosh, you'd think I could get some rest someday. I wouldn't take it if I had it, so that's how dumb I am. But, I think we could, there's some constitutional questions involved in answering that question. But let me just say this. I think we could come up with a methodology that would... that would work. And my whole set of remarks today is to, the methodology should be to make sure that if we have administrative law, that it's got to be handled in ways that make sense rather than just turning it all over to the far left. And we've done that. I mean, the Congress has done that, the bureaucracy has done that, and they love it. They love it, and that's why we have such a massive unresponsive bureaucracy in this country that we've got to get under control. It takes good chairmen of good committees to make sure we do get it under control. Having said that, there's a lot more to this IRS scandal than you think. And it's very difficult to disclose some of the some of the 6103 matters. But we're going to find a way. And all I can say is that we will be filing a report. I've suggested to Chairman Wyden that we file a report before the end of this year. And there will be a robust minority rights part of that Senate Finance Committee approach or document that we come up with. In the House, I'm going to miss Dave Camp terribly. He's a wonderful, wonderful fellow with his head screwed on right. But it looks to me like Paul Ryan will succeed him, and we get along very well. He's a very, very tough-like guy. And there are others over there who we work with who are really, really good. So if we can coordinate and work well together, we might be able to solve a lot of problems that haven't been solved in the past, especially with regard to the vast jurisdictions of the Ways and Means Committee and the Finance Committee. The Finance Committee handles about 50% of all spending in this country, and we've got to find a way of making those expenditures reasonable, fair, and necessary. Instead of just throwing money at everything and every problem that we have. That's the Democrat way. It's certainly not the Republican way, and it's certainly not our conservative way. Well, I love this organization. This organization makes a difference. God bless all of you. Take care.